I learned something from them. From Norman's book, Taking Our Places, the seventh grave precept, not to praise self at the expense of others, but to be modest. There is another precept, this is another precept about speech and its power. Not to praise self at the expense of others is to speak about ourselves with modesty, not favoring ourselves too much in what we say. Practicing this precept helps us cultivate a heart that is as concerned about others as it is about itself. I want to start by telling you about an unconscious way that I harmed others with a know-it-all attitude and behavior. In Shohaku Okamura's Living by Vow, in the chapter on the four bodhisattva vows, and specifically the second vow, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. He refers to the four fundamental delusive ideas from the Yogacara school, which was one of the schools from the Mahayana in India. So these four are ignorance of the Dharma, the reality of impermanence, egocentric views, arrogance, and self-attachment. In the following situation, my behavior would fall under the heading of egocentric views and arrogance. When we are arrogant, we're implying that we're superior to others. In a very indirect way, I communicated that I was smarter than everyone involved in the following situations. I have a therapist that has known me for many years and seems to know more about me than I do myself. She calls me on all my bullshit, and I do find it annoying a lot. But this has been enormously helpful in my accepting myself with all my faults and mistakes and to behave in a kind and skillful way. I was telling her that I was going to be giving this talk on not praising self at the expense of others. I said that I was concerned about my being able to say much about this topic, as I am humble and not boastful. She chuckled and said I was not so humble. When I have a problem, large or small, she often has an idea of what I should do to deal with the problem in a skillful way. Usually, my response is telling her that her idea won't work and is not appropriate for me. She's not shy about pointing out characteristics of mine that are in need of improvement. And again, I often say that she's wrong about them. So I'm saying I know better than this very bright psychologist. She reminded me of when I had COVID last July and how I had behaved. My wife took my oxygen level. She said it was very low and that we should go to the hospital. I told her I was not going to the hospital as I felt like I had the flu and that she was being an alarmist. She then asked me to call the medical advice nurse for UCSF. I said I wouldn't, so she said she was going to call. She told the advice nurse of my oxygen level. And the nurse said, "You need to go to the ER." I said I was not that sick and was not going to the hospital. Now my wife was furious, so I said, "Okay, I'll go, but they're just going to send me home." When I got to the hospital, we told them about my oxygen level, and they took me right in. They took my vitals and immediately put me on oxygen. the doctor said he was admitting me. He had to deal with a trauma patient and said that he would be back shortly. In the meantime, the nurse came in to put in an IV and start me on some meds. I told the nurse that I did not need to stay at the hospital as I wasn't that sick. The nurse said that I really needed to stay given my condition. I said I appreciated his concern, but I was not staying as it is impossible to sleep in a hospital. He said that they could not make me stay, but I would have to sign a form saying that I was going home against their recommendation. Then the doctor returned and said that he understood that I was refusing to stay at the hospital. I said, yes, I'm just not that ill. He completely lost his temper and yelled at me that I would either be back at the hospital or dead. So I said, okay, I'll stay. I had frustrated and offended my wife and these professionals with my arrogance and stubbornness. I was so sure I knew what was best and everyone involved was wrong. I think of myself as humble and that I don't have this inflated view of myself, but there are subtle ways that my behavior says otherwise, and I was not aware that my words were causing harm. When we compare ourselves to others, it can make us suffer when we feel less than. If we get hijacked by these feelings, we may act out of jealousy or competitiveness. Maybe we find subtle ways to say things that make us feel superior to someone or some group. Maybe I talk about this wonderful nonprofit and how I've made generous donations to them. Or I mention how grateful I am that so many people came to visit me when I was ill. Maybe this makes the person I'm talking to feel shame that they have not been so generous or well liked. Even if this isn't my intention, I still have a responsibility to pay attention to my thoughts and be mindful of what comes out of my mouth and the impact it may have. And I don't think this is that difficult to do. I have a longtime friend that every couple of months we used to meet to go for a walk. Lately, he is always telling me about the exotic and luxurious vacations he and his family had just been on. Things like a cruise in Southeast Asia or the home that he rented in the south of France. This had become a frequent topic of conversation whenever we met. I would find myself feeling envious as I could not afford to travel as often or as luxuriously as they do. He has a daughter who lives in Seattle, and both of my children and my two grandchildren also live in Seattle. We have commiserated about how hard it is to live far away from our family. I had said many times that I wish I could afford to have a small place in Seattle so I could spend more time up there. The last time I saw him, we had not spoken in a few months. He let me know that they had purchased a home in Seattle. I felt jealous, angry, and sad. Last year, I was out to dinner with friends celebrating my birthday. One of them gave me a lovely Buddha, and I was visibly moved by the thoughtfulness and generosity of this act. Then one of the people at the table says to my friend, "Isn't that the one you bought for yourself and then tried to return?" My friend felt very embarrassed, and this took away a lot of the joy I had been feeling by the love this gift expressed. About a week later, I confronted this person about it, and he confessed that he had felt that the Buddha statue was a better gift than what he had given me. My spiritual path is Buddhism, but I'm also Jewish. I was raised Jewish. I went to Sunday school. I went to Hebrew school, and I was bar mitzvahed. My wife's path is Judaism, and we belong to a synagogue in the East Bay. I go there for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services, and sometimes my wife co-leads these wonderful services called Musar, and I always go when she's doing that. On one of the walls is this large display with members' names on it, broken down into categories like silver, gold, diamond, platinum. In each category are the names of members that have made a certain level of donation. Silver might be people who've donated $5,000 to $10,000. Gold might be people that have donated $10,000 to $25,000, and platinum might be people that donated $50,000 and above. I find this highly offensive, and it makes those of us who don't make it to that wall feel less than. I suspect that some people that can afford it go beyond their honest sense of generosity just to make it into a higher group. It's a clever way to generate extra donations, but pretty insensitive to the many members who just don't have the means to donate large amounts and can't help but compare themselves with more affluent members. This method of fundraising creates a group of members who feel like second-class citizens. A backhanded way of praising self is having more or larger problems than others. I grew up with my mother and grandmother, and sometimes when someone would ask my grandmother how she was, she would grab her forehead and go, "Don't ask." I get depressed sometimes, but I used to get pretty deeply depressed. In my darkest times, I was sure that no one on earth felt as dreadful as I did. I was oblivious to other people's suffering. So I was not available to provide any kind of support to friends and family members who were suffering. It must have hurt them when I seemed not to care about them. There's a story about a woman named Gotami who lived during the time of the Buddha. Gotami married young and gave birth to a son, and she was totally devoted to him. One day, while he was a toddler, he fell in the street and hit his head and died instantly. Gotami tried everything she could think of to revive her son. When she was not able to wake him up, she started asking everyone she passed for medicine that would save her son. While carrying her dead son, she went from house to house asking for medicine that would save him. People were kind and tried to comfort her and help her to accept that no medicine would help her son now. Still, she persisted in stopping at every house until she stopped at the house of a kind and wise old man who could see that her son could not be saved, but that Gotami was in desperate need of help. So the old man said, "Go see the Buddha and see if he has any medicine for you." She went directly to the Buddha and pleaded with him to give her the medicine she needed for her son. The Buddha immediately understood what the situation was and said to her, "I can give you the medicine you need, but only after you've gone to every house in the village and ask for a mustard seed to bring back to me. Before you ask for the mustard seed, you must ask the families if they have ever had a death of a loved one. If they have not experienced a death at that house, then you can ask for the mustard seed. So, you know how this story ends. None of the families could say that they had suffered the death of a loved one. Some families had lost a child. Gotami then realized that she was not alone or different at having an excruciating loss. She was still deeply grieving, but understood the reality of impermanence and that nobody was able to avoid it. She returned to the Buddha and told him that she had been to every house in the village and did not have even one mustard seed. The Buddha looked at her with kind eyes and said that he had the medicine, but it was not for her son, it was for her. I think the teaching in this story reminds us that even in our deepest sorrow, we are not alone or different. Maybe this helps us to be kind and attentive to others who are suffering, even in the midst of their own pain. Our practice helps us to not compare ourselves to others and to feel contented with who we are and what we have. To truly see the needs and well-being of others as just as important as our own. I don't think any of us consciously want to feel superior to others. When we do, we create separation and feel lonely. For me to honor this precept, I have to practice Zazen and pay attention to my thoughts and how some of them may include my feeling less than and wanting to say something that would impress somebody or some group. I see my self-centered thinking and recognize it for what it is and make the decision to let it go. Deep down inside, I know that there is joy and peace in knowing that we all are equal, equally worthy, and important. So thank you for listening. So maybe we take 1 minute just to settle in, and then Jean will talk. So take it away, Jean.
Approaching the closed door of the visiting Zen Roshi's interview room, my 27-year-old beginner's nerves tingling with a little fear and excitement, I rehearsed my question with a fantasy image in my mind of me sitting in front of him, listening, raptly, paying such close attention, fully attentive, face to face. drinking in his wisdom. Hesitating for a moment on the threshold, I tried to do what the head monk had advised me. "Concentrate yourself," he said. I pushed open the door, and without looking left or right, I walked straight into the dimly lit pre-dawn room, as mindfully as I possibly could. Not looking left or right, going to face him in a bow, and then, "Whoa, what? That there's no human being sitting on the cushion. Only a big round orange pumpkin with a carved lopsided smile and a few teeth greeting me." I froze. From behind the slightly open closet door came a little laugh, and then the bell dismissing me from the room. So much for my rehearsal, for my image of myself as a smart, good Zen student. No boost at all for my ego. And although this happened more than 40 years ago, I can't exactly tell you how I felt, but I bet I felt foolish and confused, humiliated, probably a little sorry for myself. I probably blamed the visiting Roshi for being cruel and naughty, possibly calling a lot of attention to myself as a victim, a subtle way of elevating myself. Poor little beginner, caught in the act of trying to impress the teacher. As I prepared my remarks for today, I thought about that experience, and I also thought about something beautiful that I learned in some teachings of Linji, and I find that I keep turning to him for these talks. I'm pretty sure I talked about him last time too. It's a phrase that has been in my heart for decades. It is, "I, a mountain monk, tell you clearly, there is a true person with no rank, always present, not even a hair's breadth away." Linji was pointing to our delusion of being separate, of how our true selves are really always right here, right with us. It's who we really are. Not the masks we put on, not the masquerade. We can either puff ourselves up or present ourselves as victims, lost in our self-absorption either way, failing to recognize how totally connected we are with all beings. Linji turns us to our everyday experience, to not judging if we're one up or one down, or whether we're even co-equal. He asks us, what does it mean to be a true person of no rank? No separation, not even a hair's breadth away. No elevation, no diminishment. So I'm thinking ahead to Sesshin next week, a perfect time to remember and practice this teaching. Don't be so self-centered. Don't create disharmony. Even in silence, we can create disharmony. It's amazing. Look with compassion at my own faults before blaming others. We have plenty of opportunities to wait in line and to not get upset if somebody else is ahead of us. Don't get stuck in that poor me dungeon in the middle of our sesshin, our beautiful time to sit silently together. Try reflecting on non-self, non-duality, going to be easy looking at the waves. And if you're not coming to Sesshin, it's really easy just to look out of the window at the sky to feel non-self, non-duality. Doesn't it feel great in my body? Just one vast field of practice. Nothing I can claim ownership of. Nothing about my strengths, my virtues, or my pitiful faults. Because we actually begin to see everyone has this. Everyone has these feelings, these thoughts, these delusions. They arise and fall away, arise and fall away. So, if that's the case, what sense does it make to elevate myself or anybody else? None. What sense does it do to blame anybody? None. So, as I thought further, remembering back, I thought about another little old Roshi. I've been lucky to meet quite a few. He spoke very little English. But he clearly delivered this line, cut off comparing mind. It's a line I use often to myself, and I've said it many times in Dharma talks, cut off comparing mind. It seems that's the basis for me of elevating and blaming, where I'm comparing somebody else is less than, somebody else is more than. Somebody's done something I don't like. I can blame them for it. No. No. So, another way to be in the world, maybe with that kind of question, is to ask ourselves, how often do we actually ask people in more than just a polite way, how are you? How are you really? Steve and I had a moment when we started tonight just to say how we were really. And when we do want to hear about others, sometimes it's just for the purpose of comparing or relating their experiences to our own. But whatever it is, when it's habitually focused on ourselves, we're creating a world that's separate from others. And that world, where I'm at the center, is a very small world indeed. I think this is in Norman's book. He says, the world in which others' lives are just as important as my own is a world large and various enough for me to grow in, all of us to grow in. And because we might feel that our situation's shaky and we're not as wonderful or as talented as we ought to be, or as someone else we compare ourselves to, we're in constant need of praise and confidence building. To practice not praising self at the expense of others slowly extends the world in which we live. It makes it more and more inclusive, less in need of defending. A world in which we trust who we really are. A person of no rank. And then I read a cool article by a Zen teacher I didn't know, who said, imagine walking into an encounter with no idea of your status in the relationship. I thought that was pretty challenging. I don't mean being oblivious to what you imagine the other person thinks of you exactly. I mean, no evaluation, positive or negative, about your own worth. You just are who you happen to be in this moment. Any concerns about what the other person thinks about you are irrelevant. You don't have any worth, so it doesn't matter. You don't exist on that scale. The other person's evaluations only matter if you're trying to make a transaction. And that's usually not a place of finding true persons. He says, "You're now free to do whatever seems necessary or skillful, and you don't have to ask whether it's your place or right to say something. You don't have to worry about how you'll feel if the other person thinks poorly of you. You only have to ask if it's skillful and likely to turn out well." What would it be like to negotiate the world this way, moment after moment? We can simply be what's needed in each situation to the degree of our energy and judgment. We go through life neither up nor down, just here. Thought that was very challenging. And I think in the times we're in right now, which I'll say are challenging, that it might help to take out some of the stress, some of the worry we might have. But I'm not going to tell us not to worry a little. I'm not going to tell us not to pay attention. I really feel like there are many places that we can investigate this one up, one down thing. And Dokusan, for example, is a really good place to explore this issue. What's it like when you sit and meet with your teacher or any teacher? Who are you when you sit on the cushion face to face with someone? Is the teacher up? Are you down? Can you ask and say whatever you really need to say? Can you be a person of no rank, meaning that you're open to whatever that answer might be, whatever this conversation is? Are you a person who's asking for the benefit of your practice? And can you exist in that space that's neither up nor down? But you're also respectful, open, caring. So these thoughts of up and down, acceptance and rejection, closeness and distance are always arising, but they also are passing away. They're hardwired into us, part of our humanness. The question is how to pay attention to our wise, instinctual warnings of danger, and then to act and speak up when we see harm and injustice. Not go numb, not turn away. And also to not get stuck on our self-centeredness, to have some humor about it, to have some compassion. Tell some jokes about how stuck on yourself you are. It actually really feels good. And then let it all go. Don't spend too much time thinking about yourself, whether they're good thoughts or bad thoughts. They're just words, they're just concepts. Watching them like passing clouds floating in the sky is one of the great joys of Zazen. This present moment in our current social and political life is a perfect time to be practicing this precept, I think. With a huge self-inflated orange patriarchal pumpkin assaulting global freedoms and humane cultures, bullying, dominating, degrading all beings with his exhaustive presence of me, 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 power, 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 billionaires up, everyone else down, we really are challenged to the max. And despite this present moment, we must practice this precept, not elevating ourselves by considering ourselves to be morally superior. We can't blame others. We're not separate from what's happening. This is our country, our situation, our world, our life. Every one of us, completely interconnected as we are, is included in this moment. And how we arrived here, and how we're going to move forward. We have agency, we have integrity, talents, intelligence. There's a deep goodness in us and amongst us. Our practice is to offer our caring and kindness to everyone, everywhere, to relieve suffering whenever and wherever it arises. Our vow is to save all beings, an impossible, irrational, completely doable vow. Thinking back in my shock, finding a pumpkin in a Dokusan room instead of a teacher. Remembering that laugh I heard from behind the closet door. Feeling foolish, the image of me. This present moment is not a rehearsal. Excuse me. This present moment is not a rehearsal. And I cannot be dismissed or turn away because I'm white and I'm privileged or I think I'm too old. At this moment, I'm physically untouched by the pain, but I feel it all around me, and maybe you do too. And I feel really sorry for all of us. I feel horrified, embarrassed for our country. Ashamed, actually. And it is difficult sometimes not to feel at least a little like a victim. But that's just another subtle and not so subtle way of elevating myself. Comparing myself to who? To what? So no matter how many times I am dismissed or I feel I'm failing, I want to re-enter that Dokusan room, trusting in the teachings of wisdom and compassion. I, a mountain monk, tell you clearly, there is a true person in all of us with no rank, always present, not even a hair's breadth away. Thank you. Let's have another moment of silence. Steve, do you want to tell them the breakout room question?
Sure. So in a minute, we'll break out into groups of three. And the question that we wanted to pose to you is, what is it that tempts you to praise yourself? And how does this make you feel? And as always, feel free to talk about whatever came up for you in regard to this particular precept. So Jean will break us up into groups.
Some of you may have four in your group.